This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After months of debate, the White House won its battle with the Democratic leadership in Congress. Last week, the House and Senate approved a bill to fund the war in Iraq that has no deadline for troop withdrawals. But it's far from clear that President Bush can prevail in the next round, which comes in September. Last week, the president spoke in very general terms about a new post-surge configuration in Iraq, which is interpreted as fewer combat troops who would focus on al-Qaeda while the bulk of U.S. forces train the Iraqi army. It could also be interpreted as the beginning of a withdrawal. And two Democratic presidential candidates have called on the Pentagon to prepare plans for the pullout that many now regard as inevitable. But with nearly 160,000 troops currently dispersed throughout Iraq, what would that departure look like? How quickly could it happen? How dangerous might it be? Today we focus on the how of an Iraq exit plan. Later on in the hour, class of 2007, I am honored to be with you here today. Jay Perini on what makes a good commencement speaker. But first, an Iraq exit plan. What choices need to be made? What would you do with the equipment and the bases and the embassy and the many Iraqis who have worked for us? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin here in Studio 3A with NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins. Nice to have you back on the program, Lauren.
Hi, Neil.
And to begin with, just as a matter of policy, given this president and the current situation, even if this is going to happen, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Well, who knows? Clearly not immediately. We certainly know that the current policy is going to go on at least until September, when General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker in Baghdad are supposed to provide a joint report to Congress and the president on assessing the results of the surge. Is it working or isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
After that, depending on what their conclusions are, one has to think of what happens after the surge and what are the prospects. If it's working, obviously no one's going to talk about an exit strategy. If, as many think, it's not particularly working, this month's casualties are the third highest in the war so far. If it's not working at some point, one has to start thinking about Plan B or C.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is going to be an exit strategy.
And as you look ahead towards that exit strategy, well, first of all, the commanders on the ground, you mentioned General Petraeus, General Ray Odierno is the other, the commander, the land commander in Iraq. They're now talking about extending this surge capacity into 2008. Some politicians in Washington aren't thinking that far ahead.
Well, it's interesting. General Petraeus has said there are two timelines. There's an Iraqi timeline and a Washington timeline, and they don't coincide. From an Iraqi, if you're sitting in Baghdad in the perspective of conducting this war, it's much slower. They see a much larger timeline before one could judge any real progress. But there's a recognition there that the timeline in Washington is much shorter for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
To extend this into 2008, it's going to have a lot of political implications for the elections.
And that is something that a lot of Republican candidates want to avoid and feel that it's going to be difficult enough to support continued funding come September, unless things improve dramatically on the ground, then much less in 2008.
Absolutely.
And joining us now is retired Army General Robert Scales. He served over 30 years in the Army, former commandant of the U.S. Army War College, and he's with us from his home in Maryland. And, General, very good of you to be with us today.
Hi, Neil. Good to be here. Thank you.
And as you contemplate a pullout, obviously it would greatly depend on what the situation is then. But presuming the situation is more or less as it is now, not total chaos, certainly not totally secure either, even so, retreat is historically a very difficult operation.
Well, of course, there's a difference between disengagement with an enemy unit while in contact and pulling back from what in essence is a very slow burning counterinsurgency. But I mean, disengagement is inevitable, I would argue, regardless of what the situation on the ground is in Iraq and in Afghanistan, principally because the number of soldiers that are available to sustain a presence of 160,000 simply won't be there in 2008. I mean, if you do the math, right now the requirement or the presence is about 26 brigade equivalents. The normal rotation scheme for a brigade is three brigades, one coming back, one preparing, and one in the theater. And in all of the U.S. military, there are only 48. So if you do the math, clearly what it tells you is that the deployment scheme and the available number of brigades to perform these missions simply can't keep up with a troop strength that large. So some form of disengagement, regardless of the condition on the ground, is bound to happen beginning in 2008.
Doesn't it get more difficult as more U.S. troops withdraw and then those that are left become more vulnerable, no?
Yes and no. It depends on two things. It depends on, number one, the pace of withdrawal. I mean, will this be a gradual withdrawal with a redeployment within Iraq? And secondly, where the troops go once they're withdrawn. If the troops are withdrawn, say, to regional states, to places like the Gulf states or Kuwait and other areas in the region, that would have a different effect than simply withdrawing them back to the United States. And I guess the third reason would be, what would the troops who remain behind do? What would be their mission? Would it be to continue this close combat function and direct action against al-Qaeda? Or would it be to shift over more to an advisory and training function, which carries with it perhaps more local danger, but better long-term prospects for success in trying to get the Iraqi army up and running as the American army pulls back?
We want listeners to weigh in with their questions. 800-989-8255. Our guests are Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, and General Robert Scales, retired. And if you, again, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Bill in Wyoming.
Hi. My question is, it seems to me that we should, you know, we didn't want to give our quote-unquote enemies any advance warning that we were leaving because they thought that would be bad. So why not just, without notice, withdraw everybody all at once? I mean, we have a rapid deployment force. Why not make it a rapid redeployment? We got huge C-5A Galaxies. We got C-118s. We got lots of ships in the Gulf. We could get all those people out of there in a couple of days. And until we get our infidel boots off of their hallowed ground, I don't think things are going to calm down there.
General Scales, is that doable?
No, it's not. Remember now, most of the forces that are in Iraq right now are not rapid deployment forces. They're very, very heavy forces equipped with old, obsolete, or at least obsolescent Cold War material that can't be lifted by air. M1 tanks weigh 70 tons. Bradley fighting vehicles weigh 40 tons. I mean, it would take
for the Iraqi army.
it would take a long, long time to pull all that up and move it all out. One option, of course, would be to leave the material behind for the Iraqis, but the Iraqis don't have the technical expertise or the infrastructure to be able to keep machines, very complex machines like this, running.
Lauren Jenkins, also, there's another issue with leaving it for the Iraqis.
Well, I'd just like to add, I was actually a correspondent in Vietnam at the end of the war and was there for the final evacuation in 1975. In almost 2 days of helicopter evacuations out of Saigon, I think they took out something like 7,000 people. This was around-the-clock helicopters and no equipment whatsoever. Now, the basic withdrawal of the U.S. forces had already happened after the 73 Accords, but it's amazing how difficult that sort of operation is.
That's,
I say,
right,
going full tilt, the most the U.S. could pull out of Vietnam in 2 days was 7,000. So the idea that you could dismantle and pull an army of 160,000 troops out of Iraq quickly overnight is just not on. I mean, it couldn't be done.
And General Scales, some people have talked about an invasion in reverse. So you start with the troops furthest north and you start pulling them back and start pulling everybody back.
Well, I mean, again, remember now, all of Iraq is not aflame. The troops that are in the northern part of Iraq, particularly in what's commonly referred to as Kurdistan, are living in a fairly benign environment. And so a lot of it would be depend on how any type of withdrawal would be conducted in those regions of Iraq that are most dangerous. And that, of course, is western Anbar province and Baghdad and the cities immediately in the periphery of Baghdad.
Bill, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And General Scales, another point, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was asked about are there any plans to withdraw, and he told Congress there are no official plans to withdraw. Does that mean that there are unofficial plans, do you think?
Oh, my gracious, Neil, the Army plans for everything. I mean, we have legions of military scribes constantly cranking out plans to do everything you can possibly imagine, and I'd be extremely surprised if there weren't if there aren't shelves in the Pentagon groaning under any number of different branches and sequels and alternative plans to the current plan in order to go through any number of different types of pullback, withdrawal, or reduction contingencies.
Yet, Lauren Jenkins, nobody in the Pentagon and certainly nobody at the White House is willing to admit that there's even perished the thought that we should even plan for a withdrawal.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can ever admit what your plans are ahead of time. But as General Scales says, the Army would be remiss if it didn't have plans, contingency plans, for any scenario that one could imagine. And certainly an exit strategy has to be one they have to be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties, General Scales, is simply, as you're pointing out, logistics is really hard. It was difficult to get all those troops in through that funnel in Kuwait. It's going to be difficult to get them all out through Kuwait.
Well, there are two issues. Number one is withdrawing the logistics, the infrastructure, as well as the people. But it's also important to consider what needs to be left behind, because sadly the Iraqi army right now is an army that is not only uniquely Iraqi in how it's trained and its culture and so forth, but it also is in how it's equipped. So if the U.S. command is going to prevent absolute total anarchy and a societal meltdown to occur, then the Iraqis have to be left behind with something, and that would include such things as obviously, fighting vehicles, communications, logistics, aviation, transportation, administration, and all those technical functions and technical bits of equipment that are necessary to allow the Iraqi army to stand a chance of being able to hold on once the American withdrawal begins.
We're talking with Lauren Jenkins and General Robert Scales about a possible pullout from Iraq, what it might look like. We'll be back. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, in Congress, and on the presidential campaign trail. Pressure grows to come up with an exit plan for U.S. troops in Iraq. Putting politics aside, a pullout would not be easy. Today, our focus is on the how of any exit strategy. Our guests are Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, and also with us, retired Army General Robert Scales. You're welcome to join us. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. Just before the break, Lauren Jenkins, General Scales was talking about a range of capabilities and equipment that the Iraqi army would have if total chaos were not to be prevented. At the moment, the Iraqi army does not have a lot of those capabilities, including aviation, communications, logistics.
That's correct. Partly because, to a certain extent, the United States hasn't been willing to provide them. They don't think they're ready for it. They're still being trained. The whole training of this army is still a big question. At what point they're going to be trained enough to take care of their own security? Right now, the general judgment is they're not ready. A lot of the American military that's been training them thinks it may take 2 to 5, 3 more years to get to that stage, which means whenever you start talking about an exit strategy, can this be done relying on the Iraqis to step up and take over where the Americans are now?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the big question. Will they be able to hold on to their country once the U.S. pulls out? That was, we approached Vietnam in the same way. The whole Vietnamization that came after the Tet Offensive, which was the U.S. strategy, very much like the current strategy in Iraq, was to train a Vietnamese army to replace the Americans. When push came to shove, it totally collapsed and failed when the North Vietnamese finally pushed in 1975. I think the likelihood of the Iraqis collapsing at this point in the same way is very big.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Emma. Emma's with us from San Antonio.
Hi. I have a question about the people like language translators who have been aiding the U.S. Army in everything they do, and I want to know what the United States military's plan is for leaving these people behind. They've been totally alienated from their regular society, and in fact, I heard a program on NPR not too long ago saying how much they really were detested and feared for their lives.
General Scales, that would be a very big concern.
Oh, it would be a huge concern, and it's not just language translators, but it's any number of others who work in administrative positions in things like the embassy, who work for USAID, who do many of the liaison tasks between the American government, the American presence, and the Iraqi civilian community. Also, various businessmen who are work in the construction industry and do reconstruction projects for the American military. And my hope is that as the American withdrawal begins and as we take a temperature of the conditions in Iraq, if things do begin to melt down, I sincerely hope that there are contingency plans that would not leave these poor souls behind.
And, Lauren, again, people look back to the example of Vietnam and the many, many thousands who were left behind.
Tens of thousands were left behind, mostly because it all came so fast. The final collapse of the many 7,000 or so that were evacuated, a lot of those were Vietnamese who had worked with the American forces, and many were taken out, but tens of thousands never got out. Some took out on boats. We had the whole wave of boat people fleeing Vietnam, South Vietnam, and others that stayed were put in re-education camps for years.
Hmm. There are proposals ranging from, camps next to the border with Kuwait. Maybe they could go to Jordan or to Syria. Jordan and Syria are already overburdened with Iraqi refugees. And I would think the idea of supplying camps in the deserts of Iraq would be difficult.
There are 2 million refugees already in Jordan and Syria, and both those governments are overwhelmed trying to cope with those. And they couldn't take another wave of refugees very easily. So, yeah, that's a contingent planning has to be thought out, and what will we do? So far, the United States has not been very willing to extend an arm of friendship or security to people that have worked with it. Very few Iraqis have been allowed to come to the United States to get work visas here. I think it's less than 1,000 translators have been allowed in, and these people have been totally compromised by working with us. If they stay in Iraq on their own, they're going to be killed. When they try to come to the United States after serving loyally in our troops, they've been rejected.
Good question.
Well, I think that completely undermines any idea of human rights that the United States has tried to propose, so I hope they come up with a plan. Thank you so much.
Emma, thanks for the call. Here's an email question from Ronald at Indiana University. There's been no mention of the 150,000 contractors in Iraq, equal to the number of regular soldiers. What about them? Why are they ignored since they're a private army, the equal to the public army? How would they be removed? Lauren Jenkins, there are a lot of them. They don't have quite the same quality of infrastructure as the regular U.S. Army does.
Well, they're all working pretty much hand in glove with the U.S. forces. I mean, basically, they're a second force. We've privatized a lot of the functions that the traditional armies used to have, truck drivers, cooks, cleaners, all of this. And in Vietnam, these were all done by enlisted men in the Army. And now we've sort of pushed them aside and privatized those sort of support functions, plus the rebuilding and the construction. But they're all working with the U.S. It would be obviously part of any withdrawal. If the U.S. started pulling its troops out, the companies that are working with them would also start pulling their contractors out.
Let's go now to Ron. Ron's with us from Chico in California.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm wondering about those four major military bases at the cost, replete with bowling alleys and so forth, with the cost of untold billions. What is the real function? Will we really leave them? In a word, why are they there? And it just, to my mind, it gives the lie to the idea that we're serious about departing.
General Scales?
Well, first of all, I've been to those bases, and I think that that some of the descriptions of these, I think, are way off the mark. You know, I had one person was all upset that there was a Baskin-Robbins ice cream franchise in at Camp Victory, and of course I've seen these soldiers in 120 degree heat humping a 110 pound rucksack 12-14 hours a day, and I guess my sense is if at the end of a 12-hour day of being shot at, if a kid wants a couple of scoops of Baskin-Robbins ice cream, then I think the American taxpayer can probably afford it. And if you think there's some sort of huge, the gentleman mentioned bowling alleys. I never saw a bowling alley, but what I saw were old Iraqi facilities, in some cases old palaces that were taken over by the American forces and modernized to some degree. But there's no huge a permanent military comfort facilities that were built in these areas. That certainly weren't any that I saw.
Hmm. Yeah, may I respond?
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, the amenities are hardly the point. That was illustrative of the kinds of costs only. The point is that, and I don't think this can be denied, I've read from various sources, that there are four major permanent bases at a very, very high cost to the American taxpayer being under construction in Iraq. Will we really leave those? And more fundamentally, what is their function?
Lauren Jenkins, this comes, I guess, under the question of policy.
Well, of course, you know, if you can't stay in the country because the insurgency is so strong, which is what the issue really is, you'll abandon, you know, bases are bases. We abandoned huge bases in Vietnam that were there for a decade. We would abandon these four bases. Military builds bases to serve purposes supporting their troops. When they can no longer serve that purpose, they're left behind. Yes, they would be. It would be a waste in the end, but that's the way it would be.
Again, may I just one quick comment?
Go ahead.
Yeah, again, the major point has eluded your experts there.
No, I don't think it has. I think what you're saying is these are bases the United States wants to keep in perpetuity, keep its foot on the ground in Iraq, and keep its keep its presence there.
What I'm speaking to is intention, not amenities, and not the fact that we might, in my view, likely will be forced to leave, but the intention. And then if it is, in fact, the intention, what underlies that intention? Let's get serious about this discussion.
Is there an intention at this point to retain permanent bases in Iraq? Lauren Jenkins.
Well, let's get back to the intention of why we're in this mess to begin with. The intention was to transform the Middle East by changing Iraq, overthrowing a government, supposedly setting a democracy at work there that would flower and change the whole nature of the Middle East, spill over borders, change authoritarian governments, create an ideal. This was the neocon vision. Now, it's obviously was distorted and impractical and unreal. I think the bases were part of that grander vision that the U.S. was going to have a presence there. I think what we're seeing in Iraq today is that we can't have a presence there over the long term. They don't want us, and they'll fight us until we get out of there. I think that's the message of the insurgency. And at one point, it's going to become too costly to us politically, too costly economically, to stay there. And at that point, there will be a withdrawal.
General Scales, as you look at those bases again, you think of the enormous facilities. You could rattle them off. Kamran Bay, which turned over effectively to the Soviet Union after the United States left Vietnam.
Well, it's a big difference. I mean, again, let's lose the fact that these are huge bases. They're not huge bases. I've been to all of them. Most of the expense of those bases is in the highly technical material and the fighting systems that are maintained there. And I would suspect, and again, I don't know this for sure, but I would suspect as these bases are emptied, they would be turned over to the Iraqi military to be used principally for those very same functions. Things like command and control and billeting, logistics, administration, all those functions that I mentioned to you earlier that we do so well that the Iraqis don't do so well. So I don't see some sort of hidden conspiracy, some few great grandiose future plan that we will use these bases someday to return. I don't see that at all.
All right. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Dana. Dana is in Philadelphia.
Hey, how you doing, Neil? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, I'm wondering if it's a possibility as a sort of potential step down for withdrawal, since immediate withdrawal really isn't an option. Like, would it be a possibility to protect Iraq's borders, move our troops to protect their borders and their sovereignty, and allow what we keep describing as this fledgling government and military to try to do something without these tremendous outside influences from the countries that surround it.
General Scales?
Oh, I think the gentleman is spot on. I mean, first of all, let's be very clear. Once whatever it is going to happen in 2008 begins to happen, it won't be precipitous for two reasons. Number one is the insurgency is not that intense. Remember now, the American withdrawal in Vietnam in 1975 occurred because there were 19 North Vietnamese divisions, some of them armored and mechanized, rushing down Highway 1 towards Saigon. That's not going to happen in Iraq. Iraq, as I said, is a fairly low-level insurgency, and so the pace of withdrawal will be measured. And secondly, the United States has bases in the periphery of Iraq and could continue to even have a presence in Iraq for some a period of time, particularly with focused on the function of trying to stand up and get the Iraqi military capable of taking on the insurgency.
Dana, thanks very much for the call.
Yep, have a good day.
We're talking with retired General Robert Scales and NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Tom on the line. Tom's with us from Denver.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'd like to address this particularly to General Scales, that, I hear this wringing of hands that we're going to do the same thing we did in Vietnam and leave all these poor people that collaborated with us. And Lord knows I can't disagree with that, except for the fact, what did we learn from Vietnam? Did we learn anything?
General Scales?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, well, first, I'm a little uncomfortable, quite frankly, as I think the gentleman infers, with making these direct one-on-one comparisons with Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam is not Iraq, and Iraq is not Vietnam. I've been to both places and fought in one of those, and I'll tell you that there's very, very, very little that one can transfer from a military perspective from one war to the other. As I mentioned to you earlier, the North Vietnamese Army was a formidable force, I might also add the South Vietnamese Army was a reasonably competent force. I found them to be great fighters and oftentimes more skilled at this than we were. This war is entirely different. It's more of a regional war. The insurgency is much lower level, and of course you have the issue of sectarianism in Iraq, which of course we never saw in Vietnam. And I could go on and on with the difference.
If I could interrupt you for a second, I mean, the question basically is, what did we learn and who learned it? I mean, we're there.
Lauren Jenkins, let me ask you, you were on, what, the second to last helicopter to leave Saigon?
Oh, I don't know, in the last 10.
Okay.
Who knows? What did we learn? No, I agree with General Scales. Vietnam and Iraq are two different wars. From a military standpoint, the countries are different. The enemy is different. However, I think policy-wise, we got into Iraq with making some of the same mistakes, misconceptions, lack of planning, lack of understanding of what we were doing in Vietnam as we did in Iraq. Parallels there about what we knew when we started this thing and what we knew when we started Vietnam.
Right.
We didn't know much when we started the war in Vietnam, and we clearly ignored all the information and evidence of what Iraq would be all about.
Mm.
And that we have, the intelligence reports did know that. The evidence was here. The government was informed. It chose to ignore a lot of information that really pointed at if we went into Iraq, we'd be in the mess we are now. And the same thing with Vietnam.
And some of the problems of the withdrawal of Vietnam were sort of an unwillingness to comprehend it could end so quickly. Are we in the same situation now in Iraq?
Well, as I say, I think General Scales is right. I mean, Vietnam was totally different. First, we'd already withdrawn the basic American forces were withdrawn from Vietnam way before the evacuation of Saigon. The last couple of years, the war was fought mostly by South Vietnamese with U.S. air support. But the main forces were already gone. What was left there was civilians, contractors, some military technicians, reporters, and CIA, people like that. That last evacuation was small, relatively small, the people you had to get out. This is totally different. I mean, you have a full army in place with all of its equipment in Iraq, fighting, yes, not a huge conventional army, but a guerrilla war.
Lauren Jenkins, thanks very much. By the way, Tom, thanks very much for the call. Lauren Jenkins, NPR's senior foreign editor. General Scales, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Robert Scales joined us from his home in Maryland. When we come back, words of wisdom for the class of 2007. What makes a good commencement speaker? 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.